Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Treks podcast. My name is Jeff and today my guest is Carl Decker. Carl is a five-time Downieville champion, a three-time U.S. single speed champion, and in 2008 he won the World Single Speed Championship. He's currently part of the Giant Factory off-road team and just recently helped put on the Single Speed World Championship race held in Bend, Oregon. Thanks for joining us, Carl.
Hey, my pleasure.
I want to start by asking you, how did you get started? When did you start racing bikes?
It's been a family affair since the beginning. My dad was into bikes back before it was cool, I guess you could say. And he actually like rode his Schwinn across the country when he was 20 years old, you know, back before sunblock and helmets and stuff like that. So we were doing mountain bike races when I was 9.
Wow.
Which predates mountain bikes for kids. So my brother and I were on BMX bikes and, you know, my dad, he was a state cop and he got some vacation. By then he built some vacation time and we'd spend like a month every summer chasing local bike races and camping and just riding our BMX bikes.
Yeah. Were there many other kids your age that were racing at that time?
There were not that many. We were kind of outliers. And honestly, it's hard remembering because we were little kids. There were probably a lot of juniors. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you're 9, my brother was 7 at the time. Uh-huh. When you're 7 or 9 years old, like a 16-year-old kid looks like a 28-year-old right. person because you just don't know. Like, oh, that's a man, you know. So, yeah, we had tiny little bikes. And, you know, we used to do some touring and we rode to the Oregon coast when in 84. You know, I say this, it kind of makes my parents sound like terrible, pushy little league parents, but my brother and I were just begging to do this stuff. Like this is what we wanted to do. And my parents went out of their way to have this experience and do this all together. It was a really neat, formative time. And that's kind of what brought me to where I'm at today.
Yeah, that's really cool. So when did you finally end up going pro?
So I raced mountain bikes from 84 on. I mean, my first mountain bike race was here in Bend and it was, you know, there wasn't a kid's course. It was a 31-mile bike race.
Whoa.
Yeah. From Mount Bachelor down into town. And there was no single track because there was no mountain bike trails before there were mountain bikes. So I started with that and that made me pretty fit generally compared to other kids. So I ended up running in high school and being a pretty good runner. And that allowed me to go to college mostly for free at the University of Portland. Mm-hmm. So I actually stopped racing for 4 years and went to school and just ran and focused on that.
Did you think you were going to be a professional runner or something? Like, did you have aspirations beyond just paying for school?
You know, that was my track. I would hope to do that. I mean, that was totally unlikely. There's no money in running unless you can win international marathons.
Right.
And win a Mercedes at New York or whatever. That was unlikely. I didn't know what I was going to do. My father was a state cop, as I said before, and he and I are very similar. We're into cars. He was actually a pursuit specialist with the police department. So he chased people around.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
Yeah. He like, you know, drove around in Mustangs and Camaros and like chased after bad guys.
Cool.
So I thought that was cool. And I actually ended up kind of studying criminal justice in college just because, you know, I was realistic by then that I wasn't going to be winning the New York Marathon and I wasn't going to be a professional bike racer either, which was, you know, that was my childhood dream for a long time. But I was realistic about, you know, I'm just a mediocre runner at this point and just lucky to get through college without a bunch of debt. So I got back into riding my bike after college in 97. I graduated and raced as a semi-pro for a year and then turned pro in 98, I believe.
Okay, cool. And was that racing mountain bikes or did you start out with road bikes? Okay.
It was racing mountain bikes. I didn't do too much road stuff or too much. I didn't race any cyclocross back then. I wasn't into that yet. And I wasn't around as much. But yeah, so it's been 20 years, I guess, that I've been a pro.
Yeah.
I'm the world's oldest living professional mountain biker.
Right. And you're still getting after it. I mean, you're not retired by any means, right?
No. Yeah. I mean, I'm still competitive. I know, you know, I'm getting weaker in some ways, but I'm getting cagier and more adept at reading my competition and picking the day to make stake my claim, I guess.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about. You know, you've been racing for longer than some of your competition has been alive. So have you had to change things up a little bit in order to keep fit and competitive? I mean, I know a lot of our listeners are, you know, they're getting up there in age and they're worried about keeping up with mountain biking. Like, how are you able to do that?
Yeah, you know, I have those same worries, and every year I think, oh man, this is going to be the last year. Because I see these people, you know, you watch people and these Tour de France racers, and they're like, they're good when they're 28, and but then they're, you know, I'm 30, I'm too old, I'm done.
Yeah.
Every year, like, it gets a little harder maybe to kind of get into shape and a little more time, and you think maybe it's just not going to happen.
Why is that? I mean, is it injuries, or is it just your body doesn't respond to the training like it used to?
Body responds to the training okay. I think it's just what I really noticed, and especially in the last 5 years, I'd say, is just I need more and more recovery. Like, I just can't recover. You know, when I was a middle-aged bike racer in my 30s, early 30s, mid 30s, like, that was kind of old for being a pro racer.
Yeah.
But then I could, you know, I could do three hard days and then take three easy days and then do another three hard days. And now it's more like, you know, two hard days and seven easy days and then another hard day. I like to say that, like, the bad part about getting old is that you need to take more rest days, but the good part about getting old is that you get to take more rest days. So you just, I honestly just can't work as hard as I once could. It'll just break me down, and I just can't, you know, I'm easily reduced to ashes if I work too hard.
Right? Yeah.
It's hard to come back from that. So a lot of it is just being smart about it and forcing yourself to acknowledge that you're not what you once were, but you're most of what you once were. And if you're careful about things, you can still be competitive.
Yeah. It sounds like a lot of what you're able to do too is use sort of different strengths now, I guess, that you're older. Like, you know more about how to train, and you know more how to,
for sure,
how to compete and strategy and that kind of stuff. What are some of the things that you've learned over the years that have really helped you out?
Well, you know, part of it is just the way you race changes. Like, you end up learning about how to maintain momentum, and part of that starts with having the right bike setup choice. And I've always been kind of a nerd about bike stuff, and Giants allowed me to run kind of whatever I want in general. So I can nerd out and pick, you know, get really specific for the day and the conditions and the way I race with my equipment, mm-hmm. which is something that takes a while to know about if you're new to the sport. But as you get older in the sport, you get better and better at that. But just the way I race is totally different than it used to be. You know, when I was fresh out of college, I was a runner. I was a pretty good bike handler, but, like, I was a great climber, and I just hang my hopes of a good result on dominating climbs or being, you know, in the mix on climbs and then holding people off or whatever. And now, like, knowing my limits, I just, even in a big race, I'm just not able to go over a certain threshold and recover. So it's all about, like, letting these whippersnappers go and then using momentum, you know, eating right and drinking right and maintaining my equipment and carrying speed through these awkward sections and intersections and, like, clawing back to the group. And in the final moments of a race, like, I'm pretty good because I don't wear myself out as much as the young guys do in their attacking nature.
Mm-hmm.
So by the end of a 2 or 3 hour race, like, you know, my sprint's as good as theirs is, and I'm as likely to win in a group type of scenario as anybody, kind of. But when it comes down to just watts per kilo, like, there's dozens of people in my hometown that are better than me, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if it comes down to that, like, if it's just a trainer session, and I haven't used Zwift, but I would be a really, really bad Zwift rider, you know? Like, there's just, I don't have what it takes to be a professional bike racer, but there's a lot. I have, like, this, all these intangibles, I guess you'd call them, where, you know, it's running the right tire pressure and making the right move in the right space and just being tactically more savvy than most people would be, yeah. You know, in their 20s.
Yeah. And on your team, on the Giant off-road team, you have some younger guys as well. What are the things that they're, like, coming to you for and that you're able to teach them that maybe you didn't know at that age, or even things you're surprised that they don't know?
It's just a lot of that tactical stuff, you know, thinking about bike setup and like, you know, not only considering who's in the race and how you're going to manage to be competitive against them, mm-hmm. and maybe, you know, doing weird stuff with setup that might allow you to be in contention in a race based on weather, or there's just a lot of I'm a bike nerd and I just think about stuff.
Yeah.
More than other guys. Most guys just show up and it's like, well, I trained hard and I hope to do well, and they'll just run whatever and they
right.
don't think about it as much. And I think about it borderline too much. So it's great to have these young guys, because they're super fit and they're talented. And part of it is just reining them in, you know, okay, do you really need to show how tough you are in the first lap?
Right.
You know, you've trained with a power meter enough to know that when you go over your threshold, it costs you power later and it costs you power longer than you're going to get out of this little effort. So trying to kind of teach those guys to know when to hold them and know when to fold them in terms of showing what they've got.
Yeah.
And that's, patience is a big thing that I've got a lot of in bike races. And it sometimes is my strongest suit is just my patience, you know?
Yeah. You talked about bike setup and kind of nerding out over the gear side of it. Do you like to run sort of custom stuff, or are you mainly just looking at things that are available but utilizing them sort of in the smart way?
Ideally, it's all stuff that's sponsor friendly, that's from your sponsors and that you don't have to do anything to.
Mm-hmm.
Like a case in point, one of my favorite kind of bike racing hacks was back when Adam and Craig and I were racing. We were pretty new to the Giant team and we were racing in Europe doing the World Cup series and stuff. And Michelin at the time made these green, we call them the green meanies. They were those green tires that.
Yeah, I had some of those.
Yeah, they made one that was a 1.6 mud tire. Like it was almost like a cyclocross tire in width.
Huh.
And it was absolutely useless for almost everything. But we kept them in our bags and we'd fly all over the world with them and we'd do all these races and we'd hardly ever use them. But like every 18 months, we'd be at a venue where it was like wet grass
mm-hmm.
and off camber and not that rocky. And you'd use those tires and it was absolutely an unfair advantage. Like nobody, you could ride lines that nobody else could. And it brought you from mid-pack to like the front of the race, you know, like my best World Cup, I was 17th, which isn't anything to write home about. But like if I hadn't had those tires, I would have been in the 30s probably. Like it was magical.
Yeah.
And Adam was on the podium that day, I think. Like, you know, the two of us, us and another teammate, we won the World Cup team competition. And it was mostly based on those tires. And they were 26-inch little green tires that
yeah.
Michelin was actually selling. They shared tent space with us.
Uh-huh.
They were such garbage tires to most everybody in most every condition that they were selling them for $5 a piece out of our tent.
Wow.
And we're like, hey, man, don't sell those. Like, that's our secret weapon. Like, throw them away or do something. But, like,
yeah.
don't be giving those to all the people that we have to try to beat on the weekend.
Yeah, you know? Put them away on the days when they're actually useful.
Like, here's $100. Give me 20 of them.
Yeah.
And I'll just put them in my garage. So, anyway, I have done custom stuff, you know, cutting tires and stuff like that. The broader the offerings for tires and other bike parts, the less you have to get kooky with that type of stuff, because it's on offer, you know. When we were mm-hmm. with Michelin, I think there were really like three or four tires that we could use 15 years ago and that were a cross-country tire. And now, you know, I'm with Maxxis and there are easily 100 tires
yeah.
that – you use between, you know, a fat tire crit and an enduro or like, yeah, some kind of enduro type event. So
yeah,
you don't have to get as crafty, but it does make ordering your parts for the season more of a sit down affair. And like, you have to really consider where you're going and what you're trying to do when you know, for instance, this year changing to two Maxxis and Shimano,
mm-hmm.
not knowing their lineup. It's like, oh wow, I need to like spend a night and like confer with some of my friends that are on the circuit and figure out what to run.
Yeah.
Because we're spoiled for choice. Everybody is.
Well, yeah, it sounds like that's a change from many years ago. So what are some other sort of big changes you've seen in mountain bike or cross country specifically racing over the years?
Well, the bikes have, you know, everybody's aware of the massive changes that have happened in the last 25 years of mountain bikes. So, I mean, I was racing on toe clips for years before.
Oh, wow.
Before the SPD came out. So, you know, people are like, oh, tubeless tires, disc brakes, that's a massive deal. I'm like, man, try doing a mountain bike race with toe clips, you know? Yeah. Like that, like disc brakes are nothing. Tubeless tires, I mean, they're amazing. It's like, and seat droppers, like that's a huge deal. But like,
yeah,
bikes were really, really terrible when I started racing mountain bikes, you know, in the 80s. So that obviously has changed a lot, and it just continues to accelerate and how quickly everything changes. But the racing itself has changed a lot too, you know, just the nature of cross-country mountain bike racing with UCI. And well, it started with the Olympics and UCI and courses changing so much. What once was just a normal mountain, you just called it a mountain bike race, mm-hmm. now would be probably considered a marathon event.
Right.
And that really, it's kind of misleading, I think, because, you know, what normal people do and the normal distance that people race, I don't think that a marathon event is such an outlier, you know, mm-hmm. like a marathon in running, coming from a running background, like that's kind of the longest event that anybody does. That's a reasonable event. Anything after that is just gets into weird ultra stuff.
Fringe. Right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's totally fringy. It's like, man, that's not good for you. Like even a guy that is a good marathoner, it's like, yeah, I don't do longer stuff because that's bad for you. Yeah. Like I'm not crazy. I'm not running 100 miles. So mountain biking, you know, calls it marathon. And these races are like 2 hours and 40 minutes long. When I was doing like Norba races in the early, well, in the late 90s as a Neo Pro, they were shooting for 2.5 hours, 2:15 for a finishing time, and it would rain, and we'd finish in close to 3 hours sometimes for a normal event. Like, and it wasn't like, oh, that was a crazy long marathon of experience. No, it was a mountain bike race, and it rained.
Yeah.
So the nomenclature has changed a little bit, and that's why I think that kind of Olympic distance stuff is faltering in its popularity, especially in the United States. It's multiple laps in city parks, and it's just not the, you know, the nature of how people want to enjoy riding mountain bikes. You know, that doesn't have that frontiersman exploration type of thing where you go out for a big loop and you see the top of the mountain and you get a view and you ride down a big hill. And
yeah,
a lot of that's been removed, and so that's why, you know, these epic ride events are just hugely popular and everybody loves them. And that's by extension, that's why the gravel movement's so popular, you know?
Yeah.
There's no racing closer to my first mountain bike race experience than gravel, you know, mm-hmm. You're on rigid bikes with, you know, skinny tires that, you know, we were riding 195 skin wall tires with tubes in them. Mm-hmm. My gravel bike is a better mountain bike in every way than my first mountain bike was. And we're riding on the same types of surfaces, you know, gravel roads, dirt roads, point to point, big explorational adventure type racing. And that's why that's popular too. That's something that I think people in general and maybe Western Americans in particular, just they really aspire to that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, you mentioned that races have changed in terms of sort of the courses and the format over the years. I mean, the reason, I guess a big part of it was to make things more spectator friendly. Do you see any sort of benefits to that? I mean, are the races getting more exposure in your opinion, or has it not really made a big difference?
It's backfired. I mean, the problem is that it's a federation thing that basically all these nations need to have their Olympic path paved by courses that are similar to the Olympics.
Okay.
And for the Olympics, it does make a lot of sense because, you know, you watch the Olympic mountain bike race, it's sensational. You can see the whole course. There's multiple laps. You know what to expect. And it's, you know, it's Red Bull TV level World Cup stuff is very similar in its look. Mm-hmm. And it is great to watch. And it's fun to race when, you know, when it's so tight, it gets you know, there, it's really tactical, and it's beautiful to watch. It's aggressive and fun to race. Mm-hmm. That said, it's just not, you know, you break that down to like a national level and the races are pretty weak, you know, like it's made for TV, but there's no TV cameras there. So, you know, the UCI dictates that the courses have to be 5K long at maximum, right? And you have to have two pits, but you can have a two-sided pit. So it's natural that they make a two-sided pit to make the two pits, because that makes it so you have to have less staff and it just suits everybody.
Right.
So that, in its essence, makes the course a peanut, right? So you have, it's got, the course has to touch itself in the middle.
Right.
So you have two and a half K laps tied by a pit, and which means that what at most you're going to have 1.25 K climb with a descent on each end of that. So it just breaks it down to these really small servings of climbs and descents, and there's no flow. And then the courses end up, you know, these people, they end up making the races an hour and a half target time, sometimes in an hour 20 something. Mm-hmm. I mean, a cyclocross race takes an hour and 5 minutes. So the difference, the delta between those two events, like it's starting to, I think mountain biking starting to tread on the domain of cyclocross in terms of what it takes as an athlete, and what the courses are starting to look like.
Yeah. You mentioned the pit areas. I understand that outside assistance is something that you've kind of railed against a little bit over the years. What's sort of your thought on that?
Well, a lot of it has to do with that pit designation and making it concise and easy to service racers. You know, I'm on like the best run team in North America, maybe the world. Like, we have tons of staff, we have tons of equipment, you know, things happen for us that don't happen for privateers. And I'm lucky in that regard, but I spent enough time as a privateer to recognize that the injustice of that, you know.
Yeah.
If you show up as a journeyman racer and you just turned into a pro, like, how awful is it to come to a race where you know, it's muddy or rocky and it's easy to flat. And like, these other teams have wheels and they have all this stuff and they have multiple staff and thousands of dollars worth of gear. I mean, we go to a big race and there, you know, we would have three staff, you know, somebody feeding us bottles and then a couple mechanics and like all these wheel sets and all this crap. So to see that's a little disheartening, I would imagine. And I don't like that aspect of it, but a big part of it, you know, I think that a mountain bike should be capable of lasting for 2 hours in a race scenario without having somebody work on it. And the UCI made this decision to make it so that a top racer, you know, the best guy in the world, if he has a small problem, isn't relegated to the back of the pack, which is fair. That, like, that makes sense on the surface. But the problem is, what it does is it makes it more random who benefits and doesn't from a mechanical, because instead of just everybody tuning their bike to last for 2 hours, and if you mess up, you tune your bike to last for an hour and you run, say, one of my pet peeves, tubular mountain bike tires, right?
Yeah.
Like, it shouldn't exist in nature. So you run tubulars because it is an advantage and you can run super low pressure and it's light, and you do that, and then it's not that you flat, it's where you flat, right? So if you flat at the top of the descent, it costs you the race win. But if you flat 10 seconds before the pit, it costs you nothing. So it's more random than it was if everybody just had control over making their bikes last, you know?
Right. Yeah. And maybe people take risks with their equipment that they wouldn't otherwise take.
Totally. And now they absolutely do. And it's you still have to stop, and the races are so short now that you're kind of 30 seconds is a big deal. You know, it's like cyclocross where if you got to like almost work on your pit exchanges to be competitive, you're going to stop because it's so damn tight at the front. So the whole thing just, I don't like the whole aesthetic. I don't like people work on my bike. It doesn't add anything to the sport, and it just takes away the ability to make courses that were at one point, I think, a lot better than what's on offer now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that kind of fits with what you're saying too, about the courses and the race format not really fitting sort of what an everyday mountain bike ride is like, you know, for people who do it just for fun, you know. I mean, if you're out on the trail and you get a flat, you got to be self-sufficient. You got to know how to fix it, and it's going to take you some time, and that's just part of the game.
Yeah, and that doesn't really fit into the whole Olympic dynamic. There's no other real Olympic sport where it's like that.
Yeah, that's so equipment oriented or reliant.
Totally. Like the Olympic road race or any of those things, like your road bike isn't probably going to fail. And if you do have a flat, there's wheels.
Right.
And if they're drawing that parallel, then it makes total sense. But, you know, and the Olympics, having the mountain bike race in the Olympics is really cool, and I'm all for that. I think it's great, but they're on the backside. It's kind of ruined cross country racing, so to speak, this XCO and what people call cross country now is just a shadow of what it once was in terms of ridership and what people care about. Like, there's just nobody pays attention to it, and you can't get a ride as an athlete unless you're doing those types of races. You have to be like Olympic long team or better to like make a living doing. So it's brought up our sport, and at the same time, it's kind of cut it down. But there's all these other races, this gravel stuff, the epic rides, this, you know, what they call marathon racing that isn't really a marathon. That's just a nice long ride in the woods. That stuff is still alive and well. And that's what people are paying attention to.
Yeah, well, in this day and age of Instagram and social media and stuff, being a pro mountain biker like yourself appears to be a pretty great lifestyle. But what are some of the challenges that you faced maybe early in your career or even today as a pro?
Yeah, the needs of being a pro mountain biker are totally different. They've been totally rearranged from what it used to be when I got my first paycheck with Giant. And I was racing as a pro. I guess you'd call it a privateer pro, kind of. I was with Mrazek Cycles, which was this, I don't know if you're probably not familiar.
No, I haven't heard of it.
Not many people are. It's Mrazek, that you can look up one on Google or whatever. But they were made in the Czech Republic by this guy that was a swordsmith, and all the tubes are like curved like a samurai sword, kind of.
Yeah.
It had elevated stays, aluminum bikes. So I rode those and I raced for the Deschutes Brewery, which is the big brewery in town at the time.
Well, that's a cool sponsor to have.
They were super cool. They were awesome to me, and they're still like just a kick-ass establishment. We go there on Monday nights for locals nights still with regularity.
Nice.
So I was doing that, and then I stepped up with Giant, and it wasn't, there wasn't any social media presence, and it wasn't any, there was a lot less ambassadorship stuff than just, I'm fast and I'm young enough that I might get even faster. And that was all they kind of had to go off of, you talk to the manager, and if they like you, they give you a shot. Now it's like, well, what are the metrics for your social media? And like, I mean, that's how people are getting support now. You have to be fast. If you have 15,000 followers on Twitter and you're active, then you don't have to be that fast.
Right.
And if you're really fast and you're just a curmudgeon that doesn't want to deal with Instagram, then you're going to have a long road to hoe to get a meaningful contract and keep it,
Yeah. Well, does that shift sort of your time responsibilities? Like in the early days before social media, were you able to spend more time focusing on racing versus now? Are there like video shoots and stuff like that that you need to be doing?
Yeah. I mean, me personally, like as I, start to age out of the racing, I still win a few things a year. I got my events that I am strangely good at, and I make the most of those. But I do have, I have to take more responsibility in terms of, producing content. And some of that's social media stuff, and I'm not like some superstar on social media. Like I have maybe 5,000 followers on Instagram and stuff. But I try to make that, it's a one for me, one for them type of thing, where it's, we have a saying like no bike, no like. Like the core of the people that are following me are bike fans,
right?
But people that are into cycling, so you put in a bike shot, and sometimes it's just, oh, this is my new bike. And I hate that shit. You know, like, look at my new bike day, hashtag new bike day. Like, I don't like that. Like, that's boring. It's, oh, somebody sent me something for free and look at it.
Right.
Not that cool. But people love it because it's, oh, that's the new giant. People are zooming in on stuff and like, oh, look at that. That's the new wheel set. Or, oh, shoot, you guys are on DVO suspension. That's so cool. So that stuff I do for them. And then the quirky stuff that involves cars or whatever funnily worded stuff in a Chinese supermarket or whatever. That stuff's for me, you know.
Yeah.
The personal story stuff. And some of that stuff plays well with other people, and other times it falls flat. But so I try to balance that. And I think, you know, that has merit. It comes off a little more real than some of the other guys. Maybe that makes me a little more grounded and approachable. But yeah, there's that. And then I have to do a lot of, you know, video stuff and you know, testing and all these other, you know, I wear a lot of hats at Giant.
Right. Yeah. What is your Instagram handle, by the way, in case people want to follow you?
Decorator. DECKERATOR.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, no, the name's cool.
When you say it, yeah, it's like, oh, you're a decorator. But when you see it spelled out, you're like, oh, yeah, now I get it.
Oh, yeah, it's way tougher sounding when you don't hear it.
Right. Well, yeah. Yeah, that's cool. I mean, I think people do enjoy that sort of getting to know racers a little bit more because, you know, in the old days, it was hard to keep up with that stuff. You know, events would be, they would have sort of like a regional reach, if that, you know, just kind of based around who was able to show up to the race and watch that day versus now, you know. You can follow Carl Decker and see exactly what he's doing, like, you know, every week. So that seems pretty cool to me.
Yeah, it's a little more personal. It's great because the athlete can really control which way they want to go with it. You know, if you look at some athletes and it's just strictly racing and they still have a big followership and that's great. And then you have other people that make it more personal or funny or, you know, inspirational, and that can play well too. It just depends on who you are. So we all have this platform to like develop our own little micro brands around our personalities, and that is what makes people marketable as pro athletes these days, strangely enough, you know.
Yeah,
it's a weird deal. It suits me. Like I try to do a good job of it, and it gives me value within my team. But I kind of miss the days when I like the term of letting your legs do the talking.
Yeah.
And just winning races. And if you win, you always look good and you don't have to say, you just win.
Yeah.
So that there's beauty in that. But there's also, it's a really cool time to be alive and to be an athlete and have just a straight connection to the people that care about what you're doing.
Yeah.
In a way that, you know, 20 years ago, there's nothing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we're going to take a break real quick, but when we come back, we're going to talk about single speed mountain biking and also enduro. Stay tuned. You can't see me, but I'm wearing an awesome Singletrax hat right now. It's actually the reason my voice sounds so amazing. Okay, so maybe not, but you never know until you get a hat for yourself. Go to shop.singletrax.com to find Singletrax hats, t-shirts, stickers, tubular headwear, and can coolers. Shipping is free within the USA, and your purchase helps support the Singletrax podcast. That's shop.singletrax.com, and thank you for your support. And we're back. So, Carl, you raced enduro for a handful of years, and that seems to be a pretty hot category these days. What are your thoughts on enduro and where it's going?
I think it's where it's at. It started out a lot. It was totally unhomogenized. It was much like Super D was. I used to be pretty competitive. I won a lot of Super D's. I was just good at kind of figuring that out. Mm-hmm. Kind of these mass start downhill races on kind of mellow trails.
Yeah.
So I was maybe the world's winningest Super D guy at like national level, because it wasn't really a global thing. It was kind of an American thing.
Yeah.
And then I transitioned into enduro when that move happened, which was kind of 5 years ago, 6 years ago is when that kind of happened. And I was pretty competitive in enduro stuff, and I'd win stuff here and there, but it was, you know, some of them were super, super gnarly and some of them were super pedally, and it was kind of up to the promoter to decide mm-hmm. what enduro meant to them.
Yeah,
much as it was Super D. Some of them had Le Mans start, and we're a mass start, some were a time trial. So with that in mind, basically, I saw a thing happen in those first few years, those formative years of enduro, at least stateside. Basically, all of the pro downhillers, or ex-pro downhillers, would bitch about the course not being gnarly. It was this strange dynamic where it was totally okay to do that because that was being, it was cool to say it's not gnarly enough. Well, the other part of the equation is like the ex-pro cross-country guy that, like Adam Craig, my teammate, who every race, if there's a pedally bit, that suits him, but it was not socially acceptable to approach the promoter and say, hey, that, could we connect these two? Could we have a little more of an uphill between these two downhills? Or let's include this flat pedaling section to give me an advantage. So it was a one-way street. And the more that the pro downhillers bitched, and especially if they were, former world champs, and I saw that happen in a lot with a particular French guy, they would, all the promoter hears, and often from the best riders in the sport, was, It's too pedally every day. Oh, this stage sucks. You need to get rid of this stage, or you need to truncate this stage and get rid of this flat section, or take this, 20-minute stage and turn it into 3-4-minute stages to eliminate these pedally bits. And and they never heard anything from the other side just because it wasn't cool to voice the other opinion. So it kind of ran guys like me out of the sport pretty quickly, which is fine. I think now you show up to one of those races and you know kind of what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. Like, that the courses are going to be set up kind of to adhere to what people expect of an enduro course now.
Right.
But I kind of always like those early days of a sport where it's more ambiguous and you have to figure things out when you get there, then you get this really fun mix of people from different backgrounds, pro cross country guys, downhillers coming together and not knowing who's going to win and like having these great battles that go back and forth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like gravel racing is now, like it's unhomogenized and it's what it is to the promoter, and you show up and you figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's attractive to me. I like that.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting way to look at it, an interesting perspective in sort of the lifespan or life cycle of these new event formats. Because, you're seeing enduro is getting much more standardized and regulated and all that stuff, which is a good thing. But then, you do lose out on some of the excitement that it had sort of in the early years.
Yeah, those formative years are fun when, you don't know what to expect and you have to play it live and everybody's kind of in the same boat.
Yeah.
Now everybody's in the same boat. It's just that the cross country guys aren't showing up anymore.
Yeah.
The enduro is established and, it's not the buzzword it was 3 years ago, 4 years ago. I think it's healthy and I think it's, I'm excited to see it do well. Like Adam and I were talking like 8 or 9 years ago, like, why don't we do bike races? Like we do rally car races where you just transit and then you do this big ass mountain bike race and then you just race the downhills. Mm-hmm. Like that'd be super neat to put together. Like nobody's doing that. And then they were doing it in Europe a little bit, but now it's in the States and they're doing it. And it's cool. It's a really neat type of bike racing. I just am not able to be very competitive anymore. So I'm finding some other stuff to do.
Right. Well, yeah, let's talk about that other stuff. Something completely different in a lot of ways. So single speed, and you've raced in a lot of these single speed cross country world championship events, and they're kind of crazy, right? Do you have some sort of favorite stories from those races?
I mean, they can be crazy. It's absolutely astounding that they happen every year because they've been going on for like 25 years or something.
Yeah.
And there's no federation and there's no rules and there's no, make an appeal to some board that allows you to run this race. You just show up to the race and then the night before the race, they have a decider and it usually involves drinking and then you win via some test of courage or fortitude, you win the right to host the race in your hometown the next year.
Yeah.
And it always happens the next year. This person, this functional drunk, puts on a race and, you know, hundreds of people show up, and then it perpetually continues to happen. And it's mind-boggling that it works out, but it's a great event. It's really truly international in its feel. It goes continent to continent at random, even though, you know, it's somehow it could have been in, you know, people from Colorado really wanted to win it for next year, and now it's going to be in Slovenia.
Wow.
It was in New Zealand last year. 2 years before that, I was in Japan racing it.
Oh, wow.
And people from all over the globe. You know, it's locally it's popular, but there's always a bunch of non-native English speakers there and people having a good time from all over the place. And it's just weird, wacky, and sometimes wild. And I love it. It's a neat event.
Yeah. Well, I mean, our single speeders, we did a podcast episode that I think we titled something like Single Speed, Is This Some Sort of a Cult? And I mean, it seems like that, like when you go to these other countries for the championship, like, do you find sort of like-minded people are showing up at this? I mean, it must be really gratifying, I guess, to see like sort of this tribe that's spread all over the world.
Yeah. It's really weird that it's this way, but like, there's a certain type of person that's into single speeds, and it's counterculture, and there's that whole, you know, non-corporate feel to it. You know, I work for the biggest bike corporation in the world, so that's not what brings me to it. For me, it's just the purity of the ride. Like, I really like rigid single speeds, like no suspension, no gears. And you say, ooh, because where you ride, that might be awful. But where I ride, it's actually really fun. Like I can ride, after a good rain, I could ride a road bike on most of the trails around Bend, Oregon.
Oh, wow.
Without puncturing and going faster than your average mountain biker would down them. They're that smooth and buff and flowy. So for me, that's, you know, that's my particular flavor. And on the trails that I'm on around here, it's really cool. Your bike's really fast and light, and when you stand up, it doesn't bob and weave. It just shoots forward, and it makes you take totally different lines and work really hard and these approaches to little climbs. And you know, occasionally you end up, you know, sprinting to make it up some climb because it gets deep at the top, and you end up skidding to square up some corner on a climb that nobody's ever skidded into in the history of the trail because nobody ever would. So you're riding a totally different, you know, a trail that you've ridden 100 times becomes new again. And that's super cool.
Yeah.
So that's what speaks to me about it. Some people, it's just, you know, they're contrarians and they want to ride bikes and not they've got this kind of Mennonite anti.
Yeah, simplicity and yeah.
Yeah. The simplicity thing I think is big for most everybody. Sometimes it's a push back against the corporate feel of mountain bike racing, and sometimes it's not, but it takes all kinds. And there's a bunch. The races are filled with everything from skinny pro dudes to guys that smoke cigarettes outside the bar the night before and hardly ride at all. But it's just this, you know, they're out there in their wet denim and they're not joking. Like that's what they do ride in,
yeah.
You know, like, yeah. Like that's their thing. You know, I'm a machinist from Detroit, and I like single speeds and, you know, I like pall malls too.
Well, yeah. Is the world championship race, are there like corporate sponsors or anything? Is there a rule book?
There's no rule book. It's just kind of
it's like tradition, right? I mean, I've heard.
It's totally a tradition. Yeah. It's a great tradition. And so the rules kind of as they stand are that you have one gear and basically I think don't be a is often one of the ones they try to convey, and many other sub rules fall under that one, so you can kind of add whatever you want under that heading, but and don't win if you don't want the tattoo.
Right, that's the one I was thinking of. So yeah, tell people about that a little bit, what that means.
So if you win the single speed worlds, often these races don't have results; they only have a male and female winner, and then DFL. And DFL stands for dead and last with a different word than middle. Yeah. And so the winner of the men's and women's race, there's no age groups or any of this stuff. It's just those people get a tattoo they are forced to have a tattoo, but they can choose not to. They'll just, they should never show up to one of these races again. They choose right. not to. I won the tattoo in 08. My teammate Adam won it in 07. And my other teammate Kelly did as well that year. And yeah, it's a fun, the people that win these races are not accidentally winning them. They're fast bike riders that are trying hard to win something, usually.
Yeah, I mean, it must be really competitive.
Yeah, I mean, the guy that won this year, he's our national champion for marathon racing, and he's a Red Bull athlete. He's a legit dude. There were two or three of the top five guys in North America were at this race last week in Bend.
Wow.
So, yeah. And it was, you know, it was competitive. I was racing with those guys. I put the course together and was involved in putting on the race, but I was able to jump in and race as well. And it was fun, like, you know, a bunch of really fast, like Olympic caliber athletes, and we're riding around, you know, stopping and having bacon and like, you know, drinking a little bit of beer maybe here and there. and like kind of, I like, you know, the people that want to win are trying to get out of there. And the people that are like, just trying to, you know, have a good time or like imposing kind of a pressure to stay there and relax so, at these feed zones. So it was a funny day and a great, you know, great vibe. And what's neat about the single speed thing is that people put their expectations away and they just enjoy the event. There's very little complaining about anything because that's just not in the scope of what single speeding is. Like,
right.
People are really looked down on for having bad things to say about whatever. It's just like, deal with it. The single speed world is going to be, you know, the guy that,
yeah, you're used to suffering and yeah, you're not, nothing's really going to bother you all that much.
Right. It's just, yeah, just be cool. That's kind of what single speed racing is, right?
Yeah.
We put on a very legitimate race relative to some of them. I mean, it was well, the course was pretty well marked and there was good aid stations and all that stuff. But we, you know, we didn't put out the course profile or we didn't put out the course map GPS file until midnight the night before.
Oh, wow.
Just so that, like, you know, just so people weren't practicing. So they'd, you know, go hang out at the bar and do the other little, you know, we had concerts and all sorts of other fun events planned for the late week. So we want people to not be out there practicing and to just kind of enjoy riding other trails around town or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like you were really instrumental in putting on the event and organizing and stuff in your hometown of Bend, Oregon. What did you guys have to do to earn the right to host? Were you part of that?
So I went to Japan and was on the team that was trying to bring it to Bend in 3 years ago. And we failed. It was some kind of weird contest. And it was, you know, it was Japan. So it was obviously weird and awkward and awesome. I love Japan. And so we failed. And then last year, four of my friends went down to New Zealand and won the contest to bring it back to Bend this year. I didn't go down there. It conflicted with something else. But they went down there and it came down to like some weird eating contest stuff. And the girl that went down there with them was amazeballs at eating weird stuff. Like, oh, here's a giant uncooked fish eye. Like, eat this. And like all these other like tough guys were like throwing up in their mouths and like having to like tap out. And she was just like wolfing down all this putrid,
wow,
these putrid like Maori delicacies.
Wow.
That's what determines whether you're fit to host single speed worlds.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. So our decider this year was the qualifying was Gelande quaffing, which is like throwing the big beer steins down a table, catching them and drinking them. And it's like a team event.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two finalists had 1 hour to build boats from three bike boxes and three duct tape rolls. And then there was a boat race out around this island in the river.
Oh, wow.
With light floodlights. It's like 10 o'clock at night, freezing cold. And yeah, I learned something about how to build a boat by watching Durango fail miserably at that. But it was a neat event.
Yeah.
Next year will be, I'll be shocked when it all works out and they have a great event next year.
Yeah, that's crazy. So we mentioned a couple times, you talked about driving cars and rally car stuff. So tell us a little bit about that. If you could race sort of your dream car, what would it be?
Well, so I race stage rally stuff, which in America is not a real popular thing. A lot of mountain bikers might know about it, but it's basically enduro racing with a car on gravel roads. So you have transits where you just drive on public roads with a street legal car, and then you get to a closed gravel road, sometimes a paved road, and then you leave on your minute, and you race against the clock with the co-driver giving you pace notes. So you have pre-driven at a slow speed all these roads, and you give yourself notes, and then your co-driver reads them with impeccable timing right at the time you need them, and then you know exactly what's around the corner, and you can commit to every corner as if you've been on down the road 100 times. So it's super fun and awesome and dangerous and scary, and it's really, really expensive.
Yeah, as car racing tends to be.
Yeah, it's one of those things. So we did, let's see, in 2010, we did the whole national series, or most of it. Whoa. For rally racing. We traveled to the Midwest for a couple races, did a snow race up in Michigan, did a bunch of all the stuff out west, and that qualified me to do the X Games in 2010. So I raced in the LA Coliseum, the Super Rally.
Whoa,
thing
cool.
In 2010. It was super cool. Probably the coolest day of my life. Like, it was just amazing deal to be lining up with these heroes of the sport and like racing door to door with like tens of thousands of people watching there. And yeah, then it's live on TV, and people from bars and stuff are sending me texts. I just saw you on TV. We'd soup the car up, and it was amazing and just scary fast. And that was super, super cool. But at the same time, since then, I've kind of retracted from racing rallies just because I put a lot of time and money and energy into it that year. And I had a great time, and that was money well spent. But, you know, diminishing returns, what they are, you know, the second ice cream cone isn't worth what the first ice cream cone is.
Yeah.
And it's the same cost and the same risk of life and limb. So I haven't been doing too much of it. The car is in the garage, and it's running. It's just, I needed to make some changes to it to make it more competitive and safer. But Adam and I were going faster in this slow car than we were going faster for less money than anybody in the United States in rally there for a little while.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it was still costing us like $4,000 a weekend.
Wow.
And we were spending some of the big teams, we'd get fourth or sixth or something. We were riding that sweet spot.
Mm-hmm.
The guys that are winning are spending six figures every weekend.
Jeez.
And not small six figures sometimes.
Yeah.
It was crazy. So anyway, if I was going to race, if I got to drive any car, I couldn't handle a Formula One car. I'd kill it, and I wouldn't be able to fathom the abilities of the car. I think like a modern WRC car, like any of the little hot hatches with all the newest stuff, it'd be really neat to see what a properly set up rally car feels like, because my setup is just stuff I've learned.
Right.
And I just have so little knowledge, and it's just, you know, my crew chief is my dad, and we just like go eat hot dogs during the services because we don't know what to do to make the car any better. So it'd be really neat to drive like a really well prepped high end WRC car on gravel roads and see what that feels like. It sure looks cool.
Yeah. Is there a lot of crossover, you think, from mountain bike racing to rally car?
I think there is. In the other direction, maybe not quite as much, but Adam and I certainly had a leg up on our competition regionally and even nationally, just because we had this breadth of experience in racing. Like, we don't get nervous, you know, we show up to races and we're able to sleep, and we're able to get done, and we're able to eat, and like we're used to preparing to be our best and then like being focused and on and making things happen. And at the same time, conserving and making your equipment last for the length of the event.
Yeah.
So the two of us working together were a pretty, pretty pretty strong team. He was always navigator. I always drove because the car was mine. He's good at navigating, honestly. So, I think it helped that we were mountain bikers when we got into rally racing, for sure, in a lot of ways. And I don't think it works the other way, though. Being a rally driver doesn't make you into a real competitive mountain bike rider. There's a lot of other stuff that goes into that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, Carl, thanks for taking the time to talk with us. This has been really fun, and I think I've learned a lot. Hopefully our listeners have as well, so thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Anytime. Good talking with you.
So you can keep up with the Single Tracks podcast by following us on Facebook or in your podcast app. That's all we've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Peace.